This is Audible.
Simon & Schuster Audio presents Christine, a novel by Stephen King. Read by Holter Graham.
This is for George Romero and Chris Forrest Romero, and the Berg. Christine. Prologue. This is the story of a lover's triangle, I suppose you'd say. Arnie Cunningham, Lee Cabot, and, of course, Christine. But I want you to understand that Christine was there first. She was Arnie's first love, and while I wouldn't presume to say for sure, not from whatever heights of wisdom I have attained in my 22 years anyway, I think she was his only true love. So I call what happened a tragedy. Arnie and I grew up on the same block together, went to Owen Andrews Grammar School and Darby Junior High together, then to Libertyville High together. I guess I was the main reason Arnie didn't just get gobbled up in high school. I was a big guy there. Yeah, I know that doesn't mean donkey shit. 5 years after you've graduated, you can't even catch a free beer on having been captain of the football and baseball teams and an all-conference swimmer. But because I was, Arnie at least never got killed. He took a lot of abuse, but he never got killed. He was a loser, you know? Every high school has to have at least two. It's like a national law. One male, one female. Everyone's dumping ground. Having a bad day, flunked a big test, had an argument with your folks, and got grounded for the weekend? No problem. Just find one of those poor, sad sacks that go scurrying around the halls like criminals before the homeroom bell and walk it right to him. And sometimes they do get killed. In every important way except the physical. Sometimes they find something to hold on to and they survive. Arnie had me. And then he had Christine. Lee came later. I just wanted you to understand that. Arnie was a natural out. He was out with the jocks because he was scrawny, 5'10" and about 140 pounds soaking wet in all his clothes plus a pair of desert driver boots. He was out with the high school intellectuals, a pretty out-group themselves in a burg like Libertyville, because he had no specialty. Arnie was smart, but his brains didn't go naturally to any one thing, unless it was automotive mechanics. He was great at that stuff. When it came to cars, the kid was some kind of a goofy, born natural. But his parents, who both taught at the university in Horlicks, could not see their son, who had scored in the top 5% on his Stanford Binet, taking the shop courses. He was lucky they let him take Auto Shop 1, 2, and 3. He had to battle his butt off to get that. He was out with the druggies because he didn't do dope. He was out with the macho pegged jeans and Lucky Strikes group because he didn't do booze, and if you hit him hard enough, he'd cry. Oh, yes, and he was out with the girls. His glandular machinery had gone totally bananas. I mean, Arnie was Pimple City. He washed his face maybe 5 times a day, took maybe 2 dozen showers a week, and tried every cream and nostrum known to modern science. None of it did any good. Arnie's face looked like a loaded pizza, and he was going to have one of those pitted, poxy faces forever. I liked him just the same. He had a quirky sense of humor and a mind that never stopped asking questions, playing games and doing funky little calisthenics. It was Arnie who showed me how to make an ant farm when I was 7, and we spent just about one whole summer watching those little buggers, fascinated by their industry and their deadly seriousness. It was Arnie's suggestion when we were 10 that we sneak out one night and put a load of dried horse apples from the Route 17 stables under the gross plastic horse on the lawn of the Libertyville Motel just over the line in Monroeville. Arnie knew about chess first. He knew about poker first. He showed me how to maximize my Scrabble score. On rainy days, right up until the time I fell in love, well, sort of. She was a cheerleader with a fantastic body, and I sure was in love with that. Although when Arnie pointed out that her mind had all the depth and resonance of a Sean Cassidy 45, I couldn't really tell him he was full of shit, because he wasn't. It was Arnie I thought of first, because Arnie knew how to maximize rainy days, just like he knew how to maximize Scrabble scores. Maybe that's one of the ways you recognize really lonely people. They can always think of something neat to do on rainy days. You can always call them up. They're always home. Fucking always. For my part, I taught him how to swim. I worked out with him and got him to eat his green vegetables so he could build up that scrawny bod a little. I got him a job on a road crew the year before our senior year at Libertyville High, and for that one, we both battled our butts off with his parents, who saw themselves as great friends of the farm workers in California and the steel workers in the Berg, but who were horrified at the idea of their gifted son, top 5% on his Stanford Binet, remember, getting his wrists dirty and his neck red. Then, near the end of that summer vacation, Arnie saw Christine for the first time and fell in love with her. I was with him that day. We were on our way home from work, and I would testify on the matter before the throne of Almighty God if called upon to do so. Brother, he fell, and he fell hard. It could have been funny if it hadn't been so sad, and if it hadn't gotten scary as quick as it did. It could have been funny if it hadn't been so bad. How bad was it? It was bad from the start, and it got worse in a hurry. Part 1. Dennis. Teenage Car Songs. Chapter 1. First Views. "Oh my God!" my friend Arnie Cunningham cried out suddenly. "What is it?" I asked. His eyes were bulging from behind his steel-rimmed glasses. He had plastered one hand over his face so that his palm was partially cupping his mouth, and his neck could have been on ball bearings the way he was craning back over his shoulder. "Stop the car, Dennis. Go back." "What are you? Go back. I want to look at her again." Suddenly, I understood. "Oh, man, forget it," I said. "If you mean that thing we just passed, go back." He was almost screaming. I went back, thinking that it was maybe one of Arnie's subtle little jokes. But it wasn't. He was gone, lock, stock, and barrel. Arnie had fallen in love. She was a bad joke, and what Arnie saw in her that day, I'll never know. The left side of her windshield was a snarled spiderweb of cracks. The right rear deck was bashed in, and an ugly nest of rust had grown in the paint-scraped valley. The back bumper was askew, the trunk lid was ajar, and upholstery was bleeding out through several long tears in the seat covers, both front and back. It looked as if someone had worked on the upholstery with a knife. One tire was flat. The others were bald enough to show the canvas cording. Worst of all, there was a dark puddle of oil under the engine block. Arnie had fallen in love with a 1958 Plymouth Fury, one of the long ones with the big fins. There was an old and sun-faded for sale sign propped on the right side of the windshield, the side that was not cracked. "Look at her lines, Dennis," Arnie whispered. He was running around the car like a man possessed. His sweaty hair flew and flopped. He tried the back door on the passenger side, and it came open with a scream. "Arnie, you're having me on, aren't you?" I said. "It's sunstroke, right? Tell me it's sunstroke. I'll take you home and put you under the friggin' air conditioner, and we'll forget all about this, okay?" But I said it without much hope. He knew how to joke, but there was no joke on his face then. Instead, there was a kind of goofy madness I didn't like much. He didn't even bother to reply. A hot, stuffy billow of air, redolent of age, oil, and advanced decomposition, puffed out of the open door. Arnie didn't seem to notice that either. He got in and sat down on the ripped and faded back seat. Once, 20 years before, it had been red. Now it was a faded wash pink. I reached in and pulled up a little puff of upholstery, looked at it, and blew it away. "Looks like the Russian army marched over it on the way to Berlin," I said. He finally noticed I was still there.
"Yeah, yeah, but she could be fixed up. She could be tough. A moving unit, Dennis, a beauty, a real..."
"Here, here! What you two kids up to?" It was an old guy. It looked as if he was enjoying, more or less, his 70th summer. Probably less. This particular dude struck me as the sort of man who enjoyed very little. His hair was long and scraggy, what little there was left of it. He had a good case of psoriasis going on the bald part of his skull. He was wearing green old man's pants and low-topped Keds. No shirt. Instead, there was something cinched around his waist that looked like a lady's corset. When he got closer, I saw it was a back brace. From the look of it, I would say, just offhand, that he had changed it last somewhere around the time Lyndon Johnson died. "What you kids up to?" His voice was shrill and strident. "Sir, is this your car?" Arnie asked him. Not much question that it was. The Plymouth was parked on the lawn of the post-war tract house from which the old man had issued. The lawn was horrible, but it looked positively great with that Plymouth in the foreground for perspective. "What if it is?" the old guy demanded. Arnie had to swallow. "I want to buy it." The old dude's eyes gleamed. The angry look on his face was replaced by a furtive gleam in the eye and a certain hungry sneer around the lips. Then a large, resplendent, shit-eating grin appeared. That was the moment, I think. Then, just at that moment, when I felt something cold and blue inside me. There was a moment, just then, when I felt like slugging Arnie and dragging him away. Something came into the old man's eyes, not just the gleam, it was something behind the gleam. "Well, you should have said so," the old guy told Arnie. He stuck out his hand, and Arnie took it. "LeBay's the name. Roland D. LeBay, U.S. Army, retired." "Arnie Cunningham." The old sport pumped his hand and sort of waved at me. I was out of the play. He had his sucker. Arnie might as well have handed LeBay his wallet. "How much?" Arnie asked, and then he plunged ahead. "Whatever you want for her, it's not enough." I groaned inside instead of sighing. His checkbook had just joined his wallet. For a moment, LeBay's grin faltered a little, and his eyes narrowed down suspiciously. I think he was evaluating the possibility that he was being put on. He studied Arnie's open, longing face for signs of guile, and then asked the murderously perfect question. "Son, have you ever owned a car before?" "He owns a Mustang Mach 2," I said quickly. "His folks bought it for him. It's got a Hurst shifter, a supercharger, and it can boil the road in first gear. It..." "No," Arnie said quietly. "I just got my driver's license this spring." LeBay tipped me a brief but crafty gaze, and then swung his full attention back to his prime target. He put both hands in the small of his back and stretched. I caught a sour whiff of sweat. "Got a back problem in the Army," he said. "Full disability. Doctors could never put it right. Anyone ever ask you what's wrong with the world, boys? You tell them it's three things. Doctors, commies, and nigger radicals. Of the three, commies is the worst, closely followed by doctors. And if they want to know who told you, tell them Roland D. LeBay. Yes, sir." He touched the old, scuffed hood of the Plymouth with a kind of bemused love. "This here is the best car I ever owned. Bought her in September 1957. Back then, that's when you got your new model year in September. All summer long, they'd show you pictures of cars under hoods and cars under tarps until you were fair dying to know what they look like underneath. Not like now." His voice dripped contempt for the debased times he had lived to see. "Brand new she was. Had the smell of a brand new car. And that's about the finest smell in the world," he considered. "Except maybe for pussy." I looked at Arnie, nibbling the insides of my cheeks madly to keep from braying laughter all over everything. Arnie looked back at me, astounded. The old man appeared to notice neither of us. He was off on his own planet. "I was in khaki for 34 years, LeBay told us, still touching the hood of the car. "Went in at 16 in 1923.
I hit dust in Texas and seen crabs as big as lobsters and some of them no golly's horror dens. I saw men with their guts coming at their ears turn big, too. In France, I saw that. Their guts was coming at their ears. You believe that, son?
Yes, sir, Arnie said. I don't think he'd heard a word LeBay said. He was shifting from foot to foot as if he had to go to the bathroom bad.
About the car, though. You go to the university? LeBay barked suddenly. Up there at Horlicks?
No, sir. I go to Libertyville High.
Good, LeBay said grimly. Steer clear of colleges. They're full of nigger lovers that want to give away the Panama Canal. Think tanks, they call them. Asshole tanks, say I.
He gazed fondly at the car, sitting on its flat tire, its paint job mellowing rustily in the late afternoon sunlight.
Hurt my back in the spring of 57, he said. Army was going to rack and ruin even then. I got out just in time. I came on back to Libertyville, looked over the rolling iron, I took my time. Then I walked into Norman Cobb's Plymouth dealership, where the bowling alley is now on Outer Main Street, and I ordered this here car. I said, you get it in red and white, next year's model. Red is a fire engine on the inside. And they did it. When I got her, she had a total of 6 miles on the odometer. Yes, sir.
He spat. I glanced over Ernie's shoulder at the odometer. The glass was cloudy, but I could read the damage all the same. 97,432.6. Jesus wept.
If you love the car so much, why are you selling it? I asked.
He turned a milky, rather frightening gaze on me.
Are you cracking wise on me, son?
I didn't answer, but I didn't drop my gaze either. After a few moments of eye-to-eye dueling, which Arnie totally ignored, he was running a slow and loving hand over one of the back fins. He said,
Can't drive anymore. Back's gotten too bad. Eyes are going the same way.
Suddenly I got it, or thought I did. If he had given us the correct dates, he was 71, and at 70, this state makes you start taking compulsory eye exams every year before they'll renew your driver's license. LeBay had either failed his eye exam or was afraid of failing. Either way, it came to the same thing. Rather than submit to that indignity, he had put the Plymouth up, and after that, the car had gotten old fast.
How much do you want for it?
Arnie asked again. Oh, he just couldn't wait to be slaughtered.
LeBay turned his face up to the sky, appearing to consider it for rain. Then he looked down at Arnie again and gave him a large, kindly smile that was far too much like the previous shit-eating grin for me.
I've been asking 300, he said, but you seem a likely enough lad. I'll make it 250 for you.
Oh, my Christ, I said. But he knew who his sucker was, and he knew exactly how to drive the wedge in between us. In the words of my grandfather, he hadn't fallen off a hay truck yesterday.
Okay, he said brusquely, if that's how you want it. I got my 4:30 story to watch, edge of night. Never miss it if I can help it. Nice chinning with you, boys. So long.
Arnie threw me such a smoking look of pain and anger that I backed off a step. He went after the old man and took his elbow. They talked. I couldn't hear it all, but I could see more than enough. The old man's pride was wounded. Arnie was earnest and apologetic. The old man just hoped Arnie understood that he couldn't stand to see the car that had brought him through safe to his golden years insulted. Arnie agreed. Little by little, the old man allowed himself to be led back. And again, I felt something consciously dreadful about him. It was as if a cold November wind could think. I can't put it any better than that.
If he says one more word, I wash my hands of the whole thing, LeBay said, and cocked a horny, calloused thumb at me.
He won't, Arnie said hastily.
300, did you say?
Yes, I believe that was
250 was the quoted price, I said loudly. Arnie looked stricken, afraid the old man would walk away again, but LeBay was taking no chances. The fish was almost out of the pond now.
250 would do it, I guess,
LeBay allowed. He glanced my way again, and I saw that we had an understanding. He didn't like me, and I didn't like him. To my ever-increasing horror, Arnie pulled his wallet out and began thumbing through it. There was silence among the three of us. LeBay looked on. I looked away at a little kid who was trying to kill himself on a puke-green skateboard. Somewhere a dog barked. Two girls who looked like eighth or ninth graders went past, giggling and holding clutches of library books to their blooming chests. I had only one hope left for getting Arnie out of this. It was the day before payday. Given time, even 24 hours, this wild fever might pass. Arnie was beginning to remind me of Toad, of Toad Hall. When I looked back, Arnie and LeBay were looking at 2 5s and 6 1s. All that had been in his wallet, apparently.
"How about a check?" Arnie asked.
LeBay offered Arnie a dry smile and said nothing.
"It's a good check,"
Arnie protested. "It would be, too. We had been working all summer for Carson Brothers on the I-376 extension, the one which natives of the Pittsburgh area firmly believe will never be really finished." Arnie sometimes declared that PennDOT had begun taking bids on the I-376 work shortly after the Civil War ended. Not that either of us had any right to complain. A lot of kids were either working for slave wages that summer or not working at all. We were making good money, even clocking some overtime. Brad Jeffries, the job foreman, had been frankly dubious about taking a kid like Arnie on, but had finally allowed that he could use a flagman. The girl he had been planning to hire had gotten herself pregnant and had run off to get married. So Arnie had started off flagging in June, but had gotten into the harder work little by little, running mostly on guts and determination. It was the first real job he'd ever had, and he didn't want to screw it up. Brad was reasonably impressed, and the summer sun had even helped Arnie's erupting complexion a little. Maybe it was the ultraviolet.
"I'm sure it's a good check, son," LeBay said. "But I gotta make a cash deal, you understand."
I didn't know if Arnie understood, but I did. It would be too easy to stop payment on a local check if this rust bucket Plymouth threw a rod or blew a piston on the way home.
"You can call the bank,"
Arnie said, starting to sound desperate.
"Nope,"
LeBay said, scratching his armpit above the scabrous brace.
"It's going on 5:30. Bank's long since closed."
"A deposit, then,"
Arnie said, and held out the $16. He looked positively wild. "It may be that you're having trouble believing a kid who was almost old enough to vote could have gotten himself so worked up over an anonymous old clunk in the space of 15 minutes. I was having some trouble believing it myself. Only Roland D. LeBay seemed not to be having trouble with it. And I supposed it was because at his age, he had seen everything. It was only later that I came to believe that his odd sureness might come from other sources. Either way, if any milk of human kindness had ever run in his veins, it had curdled to sour cream long ago.
"I'd have to have at least 10% down,"
LeBay said. The fish was out of the water. In a moment, it would be netted.
"If I had 10%, I'd hold her for 24 hours.
"Dennis," Arnie said, "can you loan me $9 until tomorrow?"
I had 12 in my own wallet and no particular place to go. Day after day of spreading sand and digging trenches for culverts had done wonders when it came to getting ready for football practice, but I had no social life at all. Lately, I hadn't even been assaulting the ramparts of my cheerleader girlfriend's body in the style to which she had become accustomed. I was rich, but lonely. "Come on over here and let's see," I said. LeBay's brow darkened, but he could see he was stuck with my input, like it or not. His frizzy white hair blew back and forth in the mild breeze. He kept one hand possessively on the Plymouth's hood. Arnie and I walked back toward where my car, a 75 Duster, was parked at the curb. I put an arm around Arnie's shoulders. For some reason, I remembered the two of us up in his room on a rainy fall day when we were both no more than 6 years old, cartoons flickering on an ancient black-and-white TV as we colored with old Crayolas from a dented coffee can. The image made me feel sad and a little scared. I have days, you know, when it seems to me that 6 is an optimum age. And that's why it only lasts about 7.2 seconds in real time.
Have you got it, Dennis? I'll get it back to you tomorrow afternoon.
Yeah, I've got it, I said.
But what in God's name are you doing, Arnie? That old fart has got total disability, for Christ's sake. He doesn't need the money, and you're not a charitable institution.
I don't get it. What are you talking about?
He's screwing you. He's screwing you for the simple pleasure of it. If he took that car to Darnell's, he couldn't get $50 for parts. It's a piece of shit.
No, no, it isn't. Without the bad complexion, my friend Arnie would have looked completely ordinary. But God gives everyone at least one good feature, I think, and with Arnie, it was his eyes. Behind the glasses that usually obscured them, they were a fine and intelligent gray, the color of clouds on an overcast autumn day. They could be almost uncomfortably sharp and probing when something was going on that he was interested in. But now, they were distant and dreaming.
It's not a piece of shit at all.
That was when I really began to understand it was more than just Arnie suddenly deciding he wanted a car. He had never expressed an interest in owning one before. He was content to ride with me and chip in for gas or to pedal his 3-speed. And it wasn't as if he needed a car so he could step out. To the best of my knowledge, Arnie had never had a date in his life. This was something different. It was love. Or something like it. I said,
at least get him to start it for you, Arnie, and get the hood up. There's a puddle of oil underneath. I think the block might be cracked. I really think, can you loan me the 9?
His eyes were fixed on mine. I gave up. I took out my wallet and gave him the $9.
Thanks, Dennis, he said.
Your funeral, man. He took no notice. He put my 9 with his 16 and went back to where LeBay stood by the car. He handed the money over, and LeBay counted it carefully, wetting his thumb.
I'll only hold it for 24 hours, you understand, LeBay said.
Yes, sir, that'll be fine, Arnie said.
I'll just go in the house and write you out a receipt, he said. What did you say your name was, soldier?
Arnie smiled a little.
Cunningham. Arnold Cunningham.
LeBay grunted and walked across his unhealthy lawn to his back door. The outer door was one of those funky aluminum combination doors with a scrolled letter in the center, a big L in this case. The door slammed behind him.
The guy's weird, Arnie. The guy's really fucking...
But Arnie wasn't there. He was sitting behind the wheel of the car. That same sappy expression was on his face. I went around to the front and found the hood release. I pulled it, and the hood went up with a rusty scream that made me think of the sound effects you hear on some of those haunted house records. Flecks of metal sifted down. The battery was an old Allstate, and the terminals were so glooped up with green corrosion that you couldn't tell which was positive and which was negative. I pulled the air cleaner and looked glumly into a 4-barrel carb as black as a mine shaft. I lowered the hood and went back to where Arnie was sitting, running his hand along the edge of the dashboard over the speedometer, which was calibrated up to an utterly absurd 120 miles per hour. Had cars ever really gone that fast? Arnie, I think the engine blocks cracked. I really do. This car is launch, my friend. It's just total launch. If you want wheels, we can find you something a lot better than this for $250. I mean it, a lot better.
It's 20 years old, he said. Do you realize a car is officially an antique when it's 20 years old?
Yeah, I said. The junkyard behind Darnell's is full of official antiques, you know what I mean?
Dennis.
The door banged. LeBay was coming back. It was just as well. Further discussion would have been meaningless. I may not be the world's most sensitive human being, but when the signals are strong enough, I can pick them up. This was something Arnie felt he had to have, and I wasn't going to talk him out of it. I didn't think anyone was going to talk him out of it. LeBay handed him the receipt with a flourish, written on a plain sheet of notepaper in an old man's spidery and slightly trembling script was, received from Arnold Cunningham, $25 as a 24-hour deposit on 1958 Plymouth, Christine. And below that, he had signed his name.
"What's this, Christine?" I asked,
thinking I might have misread it, or he might have misspelled it. His lips tightened, and his shoulders went up a little, as if he expected to be laughed at, or as if he were daring me to laugh at him.
"Christine," he said, "is what I always called her."
"Christine," Arnie said. "I like it. Don't you, Dennis?"
Now he was talking about naming the damn thing. It was all getting to be a bit much.
"What do you think, Dennis? Do you like it?"
"No," I said. "If you gotta name it, Arnie, why don't you name it Trouble?" He looked hurt at that, but I was beyond caring. I went back to my car to wait for him, wishing I'd taken a different route home. Chapter 2. The First Argument. I drove Arnie to his house and went in with him to have a piece of cake and a glass of milk before going home. It was a decision I repented very quickly. Arnie lived on Laurel Street, which is in a quiet residential neighborhood on the west side of Libertyville. As far as that goes, most of Libertyville is quiet and residential. It isn't ritzy like the neighboring suburb of Fox Chapel, where most of the homes are estates, like the ones you used to see every week on Columbo. But it isn't like Monroeville either, with its miles of malls, discount tire warehouses, and dirty book emporiums. There isn't any heavy industry. It's mostly a bedroom community for the nearby university. Not ritzy, but sort of brainy, at least. Arnie had been quiet and contemplative all the way home. I tried to draw him out, but he wouldn't be drawn. I asked him what he was going to do with the car. "Fix it up," he said absently, and lapsed back into silence. Well, he had the ability. I wasn't questioning that. He was good with tools. He could listen. He could isolate. His hands were sensitive and quick with machinery. It was only when he was around other people, particularly girls, that they got clumsy and restless, wanting to crack knuckles or jam themselves in his pockets or, worst of all, wander up to his face and run over the scorched earth landscape of his cheeks and chin and forehead, drawing attention to it. He could fix the car up, but the money he had earned that summer was earmarked for college. He had never owned a car before, and I didn't think he had any idea of the sinister way that old cars can suck money. They suck it the way a vampire is supposed to suck blood. He could avoid labor costs in most cases by doing the work himself, but the parts alone would half-buck him to death before he was through. I said some of these things to him, but they just rolled off. His eyes were still distant, dreaming. I could not have told you what he was thinking. Both Michael and Regina Cunningham were at home. She was working one of an endless series of goofy jigsaw puzzles. This one was about 6,000 different cogs and gears on a plain white background. It would have driven me out of my skull in about 15 minutes. And he was playing his recorder in the living room. It didn't take long for me to start wishing I had skipped the cake and milk. Arnie told them what he had done, showed them the receipt, and they both promptly went through the roof. You have to understand that Michael and Regina were university people to the core. They were into doing good, and to them, that meant being into protest. They had protested in favor of integration in the early 60s, had moved on to Vietnam. And when that gave out, there was Nixon, questions of racial balance in the schools. They could quote you chapter and verse on the Allen Bakke case until you fell asleep. Police brutality and parental brutality. Then there was the talk. All the talk. They were almost as much into talking as they were into protesting. They were ready to take part in an all-night bull session on the space program, or a teach-in on the ERA, or a seminar on possible alternatives to fossil fuels at the drop of an opinion. They had done time on God alone knew how many hotlines. Rape hotlines, drug hotlines, hotlines where runaway kids could talk to a friend, and good old dial help, where people thinking about suicide could call up and listen to a sympathetic voice say, "Don't do it, buddy. You have a social commitment to spaceship Earth." 20 or 30 years of university teaching, and you're prepared to run your gums the way Pavlov's dogs were prepared to salivate when the bell rang. I guess you can even get to like it. Regina, they insisted I call them by their first names, was 45 and handsome, in a rather cold, semi-aristocratic way. That is, she managed to look aristocratic even when she was wearing blue jeans, which was most of the time. Her field was English, but of course, when you teach at the college level, that's never enough. It's like saying America when someone asks you where you're from. She had it refined and calibrated like a blimp on a radar screen. She specialized in the earlier English poets and had done her thesis on Robert Herrick. Michael was in the history biz. He looked as mournful and melancholy as the music he played on his recorder, although mournful and melancholy were not ordinarily a part of his makeup. Sometimes he made me think of what Ringo Starr was supposed to have said when the Beatles first came to America and some reporter at a press conference asked him if he was really as sad as he looked. "No," Ringo replied, "it's just me face." Michael was like that. Also, his thin face and the thick glasses he wore combined to make him look a little like a caricature professor in an unfriendly editorial cartoon. His hair was receding, and he wore a small, fuzzy goatee. "Hi, Arnie," Regina said as we came in. "Hello, Dennis." It was just about the last cheerful thing she said to either of us that afternoon. We said hi and got our cake and milk. We sat in the breakfast nook. Dinner was cooking in the oven, and I'm sorry to say so, but the aroma was fairly rank. Regina and Michael had been flirting with vegetarianism for some time, and tonight it smelled as if Regina had a good old kelp quiche or something on the way. I hoped they wouldn't invite me to stay. The recorder music stopped, and Michael wandered out into the kitchen. He was wearing blue jean cutoffs and looking as if his best friend had just died. "You're late, boys," he said. "Anything going down?" He opened the refrigerator and began to root around in it. Maybe the kelp quiche didn't smell so wonderful to him, either. "I bought a car," Arnie said, cutting himself another piece of cake. "You did what?" his mother cried at once from the other room. She got up too quickly, and there was a thud as her thighs connected solidly with the edge of the card table she did her jigsaws on. The thud was followed by the rapid patter of pieces falling to the floor. That was when I started to wish I had just gone home. Michael Cunningham had turned from the refrigerator to stare at his son, holding a Granny Smith apple in one hand and a carton of plain yogurt in the other. "You're kidding," he said, and for some absurd reason I noticed for the first time that his goatee, which he had worn since 1970 or so, was showing quite a bit of gray. "Arnie, you're kidding, right? Say you're kidding." Regina came in, looking tall and semi-aristocratic and pretty damn mad. She took one close look at Arnie's face and knew he wasn't kidding. "You can't buy a car," she said. "What in the world are you talking about? You're only 17 years old." Arnie looked slowly from his father by the fridge to his mother in the doorway leading to the living room. There was a stubborn, hard expression on his face that I couldn't remember ever having seen there before. If he looked that way more often around school, I thought, the machine shop kids wouldn't be so apt to push him around. "Actually, you're wrong," he said. "I can buy it with no trouble at all. I couldn't finance it, but buying it for cash presents no problems. Of course, registering a car at 17 is something else entirely. For that, I need your permission." They were looking at him with surprise, uneasiness, and I saw this last and felt a sinking sensation in my belly, rising anger. For all their liberal thinking and their commitment to the farm workers and abused wives and unwed mothers and all the rest, they pretty much managed Arnie, and Arnie let himself be managed. "I don't think there's any call to talk to your mother that way," Michael said. He put back the yogurt, held on to the Granny Smith, and slowly closed the fridge door. "You're too young to have a car." "Dennis has one," Arnie said promptly. "Say, wow, look how late it's getting," I said. "I ought to be getting home. I ought to be getting home right away. What Dennis's parents choose to do and what your own choose to do are different things," Regina Cunningham said. I had never heard her voice so cold. Never. "And you had no right to do such a thing without consulting your father and me about..." "Consult you?" Arnie roared suddenly. He spilled his milk. There were big veins standing out on his neck in cords. Regina took a step backward, her jaw dropping. I would be willing to bet she had never been roared at by her ugly duckling son in her entire life. Michael looked just as flabbergasted. They were getting a taste of what I had already felt. For inexplicable reasons of his own, Arnie had finally happened on something he really wanted. And God help anyone who got in his way.
Consult you! I've consulted you on every damn thing I've ever done! Everything was a committee meeting, and if it was something I didn't want to do, I got outvoted, 2-1. But this is no goddamn committee meeting. I bought a car, and that's... it.
It most certainly is not it, Regina said. Her lips had thinned down, and oddly, or perhaps not, she had stopped looking just semi-aristocratic. Now, she looked like the Queen of England or someplace, jeans and all. Michael was out of it for the time being. He looked every bit as bewildered and unhappy as I felt, and I knew an instant of sharp pity for the man. He couldn't even go home to dinner to get away from it. He was home. Here was a raw power struggle between the old guard and the young guard, and it was going to be decided the way those things almost always are, with a monstrous overkill of bitterness and acrimony. Regina was apparently ready for that, even if Michael wasn't. But I wanted no part of it. I got up and headed for the door.
"You let him do this?" Regina asked.
She looked at me haughtily, as if we'd never laughed together, or baked pies together, or gone on family campouts together.
"Dennis, I'm surprised at you."
That stung me. I had always liked Arnie's mom well enough, but I had never completely trusted her. At least, not since something that had happened when I was 8 years old or so. Arnie and I had ridden our bikes downtown to take in a Saturday afternoon movie. On the way back, Arnie had fallen off his bike while swerving to avoid a dog and had jobbed his leg pretty good. I rode him home double on my bike and Regina took him to the emergency room where a doctor put in half a dozen stitches. And then, for some reason, after it was all over and it was clear that Arnie was going to be perfectly fine, Regina turned on me and gave me the rough side of her tongue. She read me out like a top sergeant. When she finished, I was shaking all over and nearly crying. What the hell, I was only 8, and there had been a lot of blood. I can't remember chapter and verse of that bawling out, but the overall feeling it left me with was disturbing. As best I remember, she started out by accusing me of not watching him closely enough, as if Arnie were much younger instead of almost exactly my own age, and ended up saying, or seeming to say, that it should have been me. This sounded like the same thing all over again. Dennis, you weren't watching him closely enough. And I got angry myself. My wariness of Regina was probably only part of it, and to be completely honest, probably only the small part. When you're a kid, and after all, what is 17 but the outermost limit of kidhood, you tend to be on the side of other kids. You know with a strong and unerring instinct that if you don't bulldoze down a few fences and knock some gates flat, your folks, out of the best intentions, would be happy to keep you in the kid corral forever. I got angry, but I held on to it as well as I could. I didn't let him do anything, I said. He wanted it, he bought it. Earlier, I might have told them he had done no more than lay down a deposit, but I wasn't going to do that now. Now, I had my back up. I tried to talk him out of it, in fact.
I doubt if you tried very hard, Regina shot back.
She might as well have come out and said, "Don't bullshit me, Dennis. I know you were in it together." There was a flush on her high cheekbones, and her eyes were throwing off sparks. She was trying to make me feel 8 again, and not doing too bad a job. But I fought it.
You know, if you got all the facts, you'd see this isn't much to get hot under the collar about.
He bought it for $250, and...
$250? Michael broke in. What kind of car can you get for $250?
His previous uncomfortable disassociation, if that's what it had been, and not just simple shock at the sound of his quiet son's voice raised in protest, was gone. It was the price of the car that had gotten to him, and he looked at his son with an open contempt that sickened me a little. I'd like to have kids myself someday, and if I do, I hope I can leave that particular expression out of my repertoire. I kept telling myself to just stay cool. It wasn't my affair or my fight. Nothing to get hot under the collar about. But the cake I had eaten was sitting in the center of my stomach in a large, sticky glob, and my skin felt too hot. The Cunninghams had been my second family since I was a little kid, and I could feel all the distressing physical symptoms of a family quarrel inside myself. "You can learn a lot about cars when you're fixing up an old one," I said. I suddenly sounded like a loony imitation of LeBay to myself, "and it'll take a lot of work before it's even street legal. If it ever is," I thought. "You could look at it as a hobby." "I look upon it as madness," Regina said. Suddenly, I just wanted to get out. I suppose that if the emotional vibrations in the room hadn't been getting so heavy, I might have found it funny. I had somehow gotten into the position of defending Arnie's car when I thought the whole thing was preposterous to begin with. "Whatever you say," I muttered. "Just leave me out of it. I'm going home." "Good," Regina snapped. "That's it," Arnie said tonelessly. He stood up. "I'm getting the fuck out of here." Regina gasped, and Michael blinked as if he'd been slapped. "What did you say?" Regina managed. "What did you—" "I don't get what you're so upset about," Arnie told them in an eerie, controlled voice. "But I'm not going to stick around and listen to a lot of craziness from either of you. You wanted me in the college courses? I'm there." He looked at his mother. "You wanted me in the chess club instead of the school band? Okay. I'm there, too. I've managed to get through 17 years without embarrassing you in front of the bridge club or landing in jail." They were staring at him, wide-eyed, as if one of the kitchen walls had suddenly grown lips and started to talk. Arnie looked at them, his eyes odd and white and dangerous. "I'm telling you, I'm going to have this. This one thing."
"Arnie, the insurance," Michael began.
"Stop it!" Regina shouted. She didn't want to start talking about the specific problems because that was the first step on the road to possible acceptance. She simply wanted to crush the rebellion under her heel quickly and completely. There are moments when adults disgust you in ways they would never understand. I believe that, you know? I had one of those moments then, and it only made me feel worse. When Regina shouted at her husband, I saw her as both vulgar and scared. And because I loved her, I had never wanted to see her either way. Still, I remained in the doorway, wanting to leave but unhealthily fascinated by what was going on, the first full-scale argument in the Cunningham family that I had ever seen, maybe the first ever. And it surely was a wowzer, at least 10 on the Richter scale.
"Dennis, you'd better leave while we thrash this out," Regina said grimly.
"Yes," I said, "but don't you see, you're making a mountain out of a molehill. This car, Regina, Michael, if you could see it, it probably goes from 0 to 30 in 20 minutes, if it moves at all.
Dennis, go!"
I went. As I was getting into my duster, Arnie came out the back door, apparently meaning to make good on his threat to leave. His folks came after him, now looking worried as well as pissed off. I could understand a little bit how they felt. It had been as sudden as a cyclone touching down from a clear blue sky. I keyed the engine and backed out into the quiet street. A lot had surely happened since the two of us had punched out at 4 o'clock 2 hours ago. Then I had been hungry enough to eat almost anything. Kelp quiche accepted. Now my stomach was so roiled, I felt as if I would barf up anything I swallowed. When I left, the three of them were standing in the driveway in front of their two-car garage. Michael's Porsche and Regina's Volvo wagon were snuggled up inside. "They got their cars," I remember thinking, a little meanly. "What do they care?" Still arguing. "That's it," I thought, now feeling a little sad as well as upset. "They'll beat him down, and LeBay will have his $25, and that 58 Plymouth will sit there for another 1,000 years or so." They had done similar things to him before, because he was a loser. Even his parents knew it. He was intelligent, and when you got past the shy and wary exterior, he was humorous and thoughtful and sweet, I guess, is the word I'm fumbling around for. Sweet, but a loser. His folks knew it as well as the machine shop white Soxers who yelled at him in the halls and thumb-rubbed his glasses. They knew he was a loser, and they would beat him down. That's what I thought. But that time, I was wrong. Chapter 3, The Morning After. I cruised by Arnie's house the next morning at 6:30 a.m. and just parked at the curb, not wanting to go in, even though his mother and father would still be in bed. There had been too many bad vibes flying around in that kitchen the evening before for me to feel comfortable about the usual donut and coffee before work. Arnie didn't come out for almost 5 minutes, and I started to wonder if maybe he hadn't made good on his threat to just take off. Then the back door opened, and he came down the driveway, his lunch bucket banging against one leg. He got in, slammed the door, and said, "Drive on, Jeeves!" This was one of Arnie's standard witticisms when he was in a good humor. I drove on, looked at him cautiously, almost decided to say something, and then decided I'd better wait for him to start, if he had anything to say at all. For a long time, it seemed that he didn't. We drove most of the way to work with no conversation between us at all, nothing but the sound of WMDY, the local rock and soul station. Arnie beat time absently against his leg. At last he said, "I'm sorry you had to be in on that last night, man." "That's okay, Arnie." "Has it ever occurred to you," he said abruptly, "that parents are nothing but overgrown kids until their children drag them into adulthood, usually kicking and screaming?" I shook my head. "Tell you what I think," he said. We were coming up on the construction site now. The Carson brothers' trailer was only two rises over. The traffic this early was light and somnolent. The sky was a sweet peach color. "I think that part of being a parent is trying to kill your kids." "That sounds very rational," I said. "Mine are always trying to kill me. Last night it was my mother sneaking in with a pillow and putting it over my face. Night before, it was Dad chasing my sister and me around with a screwdriver." I was kidding, but I wondered what Michael and Regina might think if they could hear this rap. "I know it sounds a little crazy at first," Arnie said, unperturbed, "but there are lots of things that sound nuts until you really consider them. Penis envy, Oedipal conflicts, the Shroud of Turin." "Sounds like horse shit to me," I said. "You had a fight with your folks, that's all." "I really believe it, though," Arnie said pensively. "Not that they know what they're doing. I don't believe that at all. And do you know why?" "Do tell," I said. "Because as soon as you have a kid, you know for sure that you're going to die. When you have a kid, you see your own gravestone." "You know what, Arnie?"
"What?"
"I think that's fucking gruesome," I said. And we both burst out laughing. "I don't mean it that way," he said. We pulled into the parking lot, and I turned off the engine. We sat there for a moment or two.
"I told him I'd opt out of the college courses," he said. "Told him I'd sign up for VT right across the board."
VT was vocational training, the same sort of thing the reform schoolboys get, except, of course, they don't go home at night. They have what you might call a compulsory live-in program. "Arnie," I began, unsure of just how to go on. The way this thing had blown up out of nothing still freaked me out. "Arnie, you're still a minor. They have to sign your program."
"Sure, of course," Arnie said.
He smiled at me humorlessly, and in that cold dawn light, he looked at once older and much, much younger, like a cynical baby somehow.
"They have the power to cancel my entire program for another year if they want to, and substitute their own. They could sign me up for Home Ec and World of Fashion if they wanted to. The law says they can do it. But no law says they can make me pass what they pick."
That brought it home to me. The distance he had gone, I mean. How could that old clunker of a car have come to mean so much to him so damn fast? In the following days, that question kept coming at me in different ways, the way I've always imagined a fresh grief would. When Arnie told Michael and Regina he meant to have it, He sure hadn't been kidding. He had gone right to that place where their expectations for him lived the most strongly, and he had done it with a ruthless expediency that surprised me. I'm not sure that lesser tactics would have worked against Regina, but that Arnie had actually been able to do it surprised me. In fact, it surprised the shit out of me. What it boiled down to was if Arnie spent his senior year in VT, college went out the window. And to Michael and Regina, that was an impossibility. So they just gave up? It was close to punch-in time, but I couldn't let this go until I knew everything. Not just like that, no. I told them I'd find garage space for it and that I wouldn't try to have it inspected or registered until I had their approval. Do you think you're going to get that? He flashed me a grim smile that was somehow both confident and scary. It was the smile of a bulldozer operator lowering the blade of a DC-9 cat in front of a particularly difficult stump. I'll get it, he said. When I'm ready, I'll get it. And you know what? I believed he would. Chapter 4. Arnie Gets Married. We could have had 2 hours of overtime that Friday evening, but we declined it. We picked up our checks in the office and drove down to the Libertyville branch of Pittsburgh Savings and Loan and cashed them. I dumped most of mine into my savings account, put 50 into my checking account. Just having one of those made me feel disquietingly adult. The feeling, I suppose, wears off. And held on to 20 in cash. Arnie drew all of his in cash. Here, he said, holding out a 10 spot. No, I said. You hang on to it, man. You'll need every penny of it before you're through with that clunk. Take it, he said. I pay my debts, Dennis. Keep it, really. Take it. He held the money out inexorably. I took it, but I made him take the dollar he had coming back. He didn't want to do that. Driving across town to LeBay's tract house, Arnie got more jittery, playing the radio too loud, beating boogie riffs first on his thighs and then on the dashboard. Foreigner came on, singing Dirty White Boy. Story of my life, Arnie, my man, I said, and he laughed, too loud and too long. He was acting like a man waiting for his wife to have a baby. At last, I guessed he was scared LeBay had sold the car out from under him. Arnie, I said, stay cool, it'll be there. I'm cool, he said, and offered me a large, glowing, false smile. His complexion that day was the worst I ever saw it, and I wondered, not for the first time or the last, what it must be like to be Arnie Cunningham, trapped behind that oozing face from second to second and minute to minute and... Well, just stop sweating. You act like you're going to make lemonade in your pants before we get there. I'm not, he said, and beat another quick, nervous riff on the dashboard just to show me how nervous he wasn't. Dirty White Boy by Foreigner gave way to Jukebox Hero by Foreigner. It was Friday afternoon, and the block party weekend had started on FM 104. When I look back on that year, my senior year, it seems to me that I could measure it out in blocks of rock. And an escalating, dreamlike sense of terror. What exactly is it? I asked. What is it about this car? He sat looking out at Libertyville Avenue without saying anything for a long time. And then he turned off the radio with a quick snap, cutting off Foreigner in mid-flight. I don't know exactly, he said. Maybe it's because for the first time since I was 11 and started getting pimples, I've seen something even uglier than I am. Is that what you want me to say? Does that let you put it in a neat little category? Hey, Arnie, come on, I said. This is Dennis here, remember me? I remember, he said. And we're still friends, right? Sure, last time I checked, but what has that got to do with... And that means we don't have to lie to each other. Or at least, I think that's what it's supposed to mean. So, I gotta tell you, maybe it's not all jive. I know what I am. I'm ugly.
I don't make friends easily. I alienate people somehow. I don't mean to do it, but somehow I do, you know?
I nodded with some reluctance. As he said, we were friends, and that meant keeping the bullshit to a bare